February 7th, 2019. The time is 9:04. I apologize for the delay in getting all of the technical stuff together, but we're there now and ready to go. In attendance, myself, Senator Stevens, Senator Birch, Senator Begich, Senator Hughes, and Costello are have another commitment. They'll be here as soon as they can. We have a quorum to conduct business. Today we're going to be hearing several presentations on the earthquake that occurred November 30th, 2018. And the resultant damage to schools in the Anchorage and Matsu area. Our presenters will be Dr. Mike West, state seismologist, director of the Alaska Earthquake Center, Tim Edwards, the chief risk officer at the University of Alaska, Tim Mehring, facilities manager, Department of Education Early Development, Mike Brown, the executive director of operations, Matsu School District, and Dr. Dina Bishop, the superintendent of the Anchorage School District. So thank you all very much. Any questions before we start? Well, let's begin then. We'll start with Dr. Mike West. Thank you very much for being here, sir. And if you'd put your name on the record, please, and your position.
All right. It's working? Yes. Michael West, state seismologist. I direct the Alaska Earthquake Center at the Geophysical Institute at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So, Chair, members of the committee, and everyone else in attendance, I thank you for your time over the next few minutes. I'll try to give you a little bit of insight into what we do and the recent events and tee up, hopefully, presentations by others. So whether you know the Alaska Earthquake Center or not, I think all of you are very aware of the products and the things that we do. So one of the things that you will know from us is rapid assessment of earthquakes. So after an earthquake happens, that most basic of information, you know, where an earthquake happened, how big it was, how what the extent of shaking was, is information that you can get from apps, you get it from media, get it from federal agencies like the USGS, but ultimately that information is derived at the Alaska Earthquake Center here in state. Another thing you might know us from is if you've been in any of our coastal communities and seen tsunami evacuation signs or hazard signs, those are premised on an understanding of what areas of a community are in the potential flood zone and which ones are not. That is an activity carried out over the last several decades to map community by community our tsunami hazards in the state, carried out by the Earthquake Center. And the last thing I would single out is sort of the research and analysis of why earthquakes happen in Alaska and what we should expect in the future. This is a figure in front of you of all of the earthquakes that occurred or were large enough to be recorded in 2018. There's about 55,000 events on there. The vast majority are very small. And a lot of those are sort of our usual players. They're not a surprise, geologically speaking. But there are other things on there that stand out. There are things that we don't expect. And when that occurs, it's our responsibility to figure out why those occurred and what we could expect from those areas going forward. So who cares? Lots of people. But some of the applications of our data are baked into other processes that you may or may not be aware of. So all of our building codes have, as part of their core requirements, an adherence to seismic standards that are based on the image I just showed, where, you know, what that history of earthquakes is and what we anticipate going forward. Any large, environmental reviews for large development projects have in them an extensive consideration of how to make sure that we're building safely for the seismic hazards. Our insurance rates have built into them some consideration of the likelihood of different types of earthquakes in different places. All of the evacuation routes and shelters for tsunami hazards in our communities incorporate that, and any of our communities that have hazard mitigation plans usually have a section therein where they examine and plan for seismic and tsunami events. Just a couple of examples.
My questions along the way.
So, Chair, it's up to you.
Could you talk about the insurance rates? Do most folks covered by tsunami and earthquake, or is that something that we're
so two different pieces of this. One is the topic of earthquake insurance. The other is just your core homeowners insurance rates. Now, that's not something that is a public information. That's a proprietary formulas, if you will, run by companies. But I guarantee you that behind the scenes, They are factoring in some way, understandably, legitimately, the earthquake potential in calculating overall rates, though, again, the details are probably not made public. Earthquake insurance, then, would be an add-on that some people have, some people don't. A lot of very fair discussion about what does and doesn't make sense, and I think I diverged from your original question.
No, that's very good of you to do that. Okay. My communities are all southern coast, Kodiak, Homer, that area, and I don't even know if my insurance covers a tsunami, but it's something that we'd be well to look at.
I agree do well to look at, and I am not an authority on what insurance does and doesn't cover. But
thank you. Since we're asking questions, Mike, I go to your site all the time, and I think a lot of us who went through the November 30th quake flip back to the site to see how many quakes and look for the little red that's there and the, you know, for our low, our, what is it, our low bandwidth, you know, instruments. Mm-hmm. And in the process of doing that, I noted, and I see it on your map here, of the earthquake zone, significant activity in Kaktovik. And I actually had my office call, I think your office, and ask about that. It concerns me only because I've seen it now when I look through those pages and pages and pages of, you know, since November 30th of earthquakes, and I'm seeing more and more of these 6.0s, 4.0s, 3.9s, 3.8s.
Up north.
That's where our wealth is. What's that?
Oh, forgive
yeah,
me.
That's where our wealth comes from, right? You know, it's from the North Slope. So what's going on there in Kaktovik?
Through the chair.
Please.
Very simple. On August 12th, there were two very significant earthquakes. About maybe 50 miles or so from, that's right, a 6.4 and 6.0 earthquake. They have been very prodigious aftershocks following on from that, and pretty much everything we're seeing up there, it can be attributed to aftershock activity from those events. The bigger question is, why did those earthquakes occur in the first place? And that's something we're still wrapping our heads around. It's not a surprise to have earthquakes in that area, but those were by far the most significant earthquakes on the North Slope in recorded history.
And Senator Stevens, the reason I bring that up is, of course, that's you know, where we derive a great portion of our wealth comes out of the oil on the North Slope, and it's fairly near our field. So I just thought that would be something we'd want to know more about. Perhaps at some point we could delve more deeply into that and the potential protections and consequences of that.
I will say that our producers and the companies that work in that area are aware of seismic hazards and have been very forward about planning and taking precautions and monitoring their own facilities up there, Alyeska being a leader for sure in that activity. But got everyone's attention.
Thank you. Yes. So. Thanks very much. Please continue, Dr. West.
All right, I'm going to go ahead. My intent is simply to show that that information gets used, whether we're building ports, all of our major development projects, every school in the state has at some point during its construction attempted to factor in the best information at that point in time. Why do we do this? I want to take just a moment to point out that you, the legislature, are the ones who put this task of earthquake monitoring to the university many years ago, and I would single out in that the designation of the role of state seismologist, a position that a role that I'm currently serving in, and I bring that up only to make clear that though I am an employee of the university and the Geophysical Institute, I answer to you. So the kinds of questions that you're bringing forward are legitimate, appropriate, and I hope that will continue long beyond this hearing today. How do we do this? We operate a monitoring network across the state. The dots on this map represent places where we have seismic monitoring instrumentation, and when an earthquake occurs, the vibrations from the ground that are recorded by those stations are all streamed in real time back to our headquarters in Fairbanks, and that data is all sort of assimilated and put together to try and make sense of what just happened. Out on the field, each site looks something like this, fairly familiar if you've been in the backcountry, not that different from what other agencies operate, a self-contained power system, a sensor in the ground, and then the key piece, I think, is radio communication that allows that data to all be aggregated in real time back at our center. I do encourage you, if you're in Fairbanks, to look us up, give me a heads up, and come through. I think we show fairly well. There's a lot of really interesting things to see. I very much think of us as sort of taking the pulse of Alaska, because quite truly, anything that vibrates the ground, landslide, earthquake, explosion, you name it, registers somewhere on one of our monitors.
Dr. West, I see that there are several sites in Canada, and do you work then with Yukon Territory? Do you work with Canada? Are those our installations out there? Are we working?
I should have pointed out on the previous slide that we do have a lot of partner organizations that we work with, for sure, and we work very closely with Canadians. Our earthquakes don't really obey political boundaries, and we share everything back and forth with the Canadians and others. So I wanted to give a couple of examples of the kinds of ways that people work with our data to answer meaningful questions. One of the ways that this is done is simply to assess where was shaking strong and where was it not. This is a particular example along the pipeline where these are actual recordings from an earthquake a couple of years ago that very quickly help engineers assess what places probably where they should be focusing their attention, and quite importantly, where they probably don't have to worry about. So decision support tools for folks making rapid decisions after an earthquake. We've been answering a lot of questions the last 2 months or so, trying to put the November 30 earthquake into perspective. Was that a worst-case scenario? That's a question we've gotten quite a lot as we plan and what comes after this. And the answer to that is a very clear no. We need only look at our own history back to 1964 to know that. But very key in this is that the next earthquake will look very different than this. It won't shake in the same way. The patterns will be different. The ways that the ground are excited will be different. We've been answering a lot of questions about whether or not an earthquake like November 30 can happen elsewhere in the state. I'll single out Juneau in the interior here, but Juneau, well, if we take a look at, again, at the historical record of earthquakes, the dots in red shown on this map here, the answer for Juneau is that Southeast is more than capable of magnitude 7 and significantly larger earthquakes. However, they are likely to be some distance away from Juneau proper. So they'll manifest themselves quite differently, I think, than the Anchorage earthquake. Fairbanks. Fairbanks has a long history of earthquakes in the magnitude, high magnitude 6s and low magnitude 7s. So the answer is an unequivocal yes, that earthquake is possible in Fairbanks. However, history demonstrates that it is less likely, or shall we say, not as frequent an event as it would be in South Central. A lot of questions about aftershocks. I won't take you through the technical details of the slide, but what this slide shows is that if we take the rate of aftershocks over the last 2 months and project forward, within about a year, let's say by the end of 2019, it will become difficult to distinguish an aftershock from what is the background level of seismic activity that we are accustomed to living with. This is an analysis that just came out from our seismic analysts a few days ago. Another question we've spent a lot of time with, where was the shaking most violent, or what was the distribution of shaking? And in particular, I'll call your attention to the inset. And while this is just a color-coded slide, I don't have numbers on this, we measure and estimate the actual amount of ground shaking across the whole region. And I will point out that if you look on the inset map at Anchorage and the Eagle River area and Palmer and Wasilla and Willow, you will see, by and large, about the same amount of shaking. This has been a particular question vis-a-vis the disproportionate damage in the Eagle River area. And while there are significant variations, sort of neighborhood by neighborhood, on a regional scale, Eagle River probably did not experience shaking that was significantly stronger than elsewhere. Thus, we look to other explanations for some of the damage. All right. I'm very proud of the people that I work with and our mission. We have a lot to do. This slide is actually based on data. 4 out of 5 earthquakes in the United States occur in Alaska, and that keeps us quite busy. I'm keenly aware, though, in my role, perhaps more than most people, of where our shortcomings are, both as an organization and as a state. One of our fundamental challenges in this state is limited observations. When we compare ourselves to the lower 48, we don't have available many of the resources and tools that would be available in other places. A colleague of mine made this slide a few years ago. This is a map of those stations that I showed you a few minutes ago. This is our observation system, our telescope, if you will. And if we take the state of California and overlay it in western Alaska, we can see a region the size of California that has 3 seismic sensors in it. And while I do not want to downplay the significance of California's earthquake risk, very real, very legitimate, very appropriate, there is something of a disparity between the two states. If I look at the seismic monitoring system that California uses. And that brings with it different capabilities. If we were thinking about doing astronomy, you know, what California has is sort of the Hubble telescope. You see events with crystal clarity. You can understand them. Whereas in some parts of Alaska, doing earthquake monitoring is a bit like astronomy with a pair of binoculars. You kind of tell there's some stuff going on, but you don't really know the details. And, you know, if I were to single out why that matters, what that really means, let me give you just one example. Along the western coast of the U.S. right now, California, Oregon, Washington, they are rolling out on an operational basis earthquake early warning, the basic concept of which is that if you can detect an earthquake very rapidly and warn people in advance of the seismic waves, you can give them 5, 10, 30, 60 seconds potentially of warning before that shaking hits. That is a reality now in parts of this country, and it is not something that is even being considered at the moment in Alaska because we do not have the foundation on which to build that kind of system. This is the monitoring network that I showed you just a few minutes ago. I was somewhat dishonest in that at the moment we are actually using something very different than this. The next slide here shows the monitoring system that is actually in place today. We have our Hubble telescope. We have been benefiting tremendously over the last 3 years from a massive rollout of earthquake monitoring or seismic instrumentation through a National Science Foundation project, and we have been benefiting tremendously from that. I won't dwell on it, but this is going away in 2020, and we have mounted an extensive campaign with federal agencies, with our congressional delegation, and actually a capital project that you will see come through this building later on in the session through the university that attempts to retain some portions of this. There is a poster out in the hall that I would encourage anyone to take. It has on it the full details of this project, and yeah, beware.
Mike, why is it going away?
Because it's a research project. Their objective, I know that sounds odd, but from a research perspective, the way the National Science Foundation operates, much like a science fair project, you go out, you conduct an experiment, you get your data, and then you go home and you know, you research it and move on to your next project. It was built with different objectives than the day-to-day, year-to-year, decade-to-decade monitoring, which is the focus of my organization.
So here was a photo of a seismic station. Are all of these dots actually the similar seismic station?
They are quite similar to what we currently operate. The data is all public and open. We've been using it. Let me be very clear. We've been using it to great effect. We could not have tracked those Kaktovik earthquakes without them. You look where Kaktovik is on this map. The closest 12 seismic stations during that earthquake were all part of this project, and they are slated for removal in June of 2020. So I'd like to move on so we can get to some of the parts that are relevant to
You're asking me to ask Senator Begich to be quiet?
No, forgive me. I was actually giving myself permission to skip the next couple of slides.
Yeah, I do. I still have a question. I mean, what would it take for us? Is the capital project you're proposing that we're going to see at some point here, is that capital project entail us taking over those sites so that they're not removed? And how fast does that have to happen before they actually come in and remove their science project?
Yes. The goal is to assume ownership and long-term operations, integration into our existing state network of a subset, not all, something like half, of that existing facility. The way we would do that, we are pursuing at the federal level $48 million, which would operate the system for a decade. We have very strong partnerships and engagement from several federal agencies. That's a very active, let's call it discussion, right now. What we're seeking in state capital funds is I could only characterize as Kickstarter funds, something to help seed this with.
And Mr. Chairman, I mean it seems like a small investment to keep our oil and gas partners whole. Should there, it just seems to me to make some sense, but we'll get into that later, I'm sure.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Birch.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've seen a lot of remote sensing capability for measuring, you know, ocean elevation and stuff, and I know that technology is increasing and increasingly sensitive every, you know, every year it kind of improves. Is there any potential for remote sensing to provide, you know, satellite basically? Do you get the granularity that you need? I assume you've got to have be on the ground for most of it, but can that be a contributor?
Yes, in a word. There are many different technologies that come together today to form our earthquake monitoring capabilities. GPS sensors, actually, remarkably capable. Even in certain locations, you'd be surprised what your cell phone and the accelerometer that is built into it can actually provide. So, yes, we live in a world of very diverse technologies. Satellite imagery is very useful, actually has excellent granularity. What it lacks is temporal coverage. You know, a pass every few days or something is not the same as a sample, you know, 100 samples a second. But absolutely, it's one piece of the solution.
Thank you, Senator. Please.
I wanted to walk through just a couple of slides and wrap up here of a few things that I think are germane to the education discussion. One,
what page are we on?
I'm sorry, I went past, let's see.
One more.
It looks like this. It has a building codes booklet on it. A very simple point, but I wanted to reinforce the notion that the codes that we build to, whether it's in South Central, whether it's on, you know, the North Slope, anywhere else, are built into them the seismic record that is changing and evolving constantly, you know, year to year. It's a simple point, but that's the difference. That's why we can build. We know in certain areas that we need to build to a fairly high standard, but it also allows us in other places to say, you know what, actually, that's an investment we don't need to make here. We can get away with, and not get away with, it's appropriate to build to a lesser standard. Another point that I wanted to make, I'm not going to show one of the videos here, but hopefully everyone in the room has seen one of the several videos of school children responding to the November 30 earthquake with drop, cover, and hold responses. And I think that's really quite remarkable. That's not an accident that happened. There's been a very concerted effort over many years, certainly supported by, you know, Department of Education and all the teachers and everyone in the chain to train students in what's a very basic but really well-executed practice. Getting underneath the table during an earthquake is not an excuse for not building, you know, good buildings and taking care of our larger issues. However, that's a really important piece of the puzzle, and I think everybody deserves some accolades for their responses on that day. A third point I would make is that in any particular school district, I am quite sure that the engineers, and we'll hear about it today, I'm sure, make some prioritization of, you know, where are the buildings that we need to focus our attention on? Again, which ones are actually probably quite safe? I wanted to point out that over the last half dozen years, the Alaska Seismic Hazard Safety Commission has been systematically pursuing support through FEMA and carrying out projects. These five examples up on the screen, if you read closely, are actually five different school districts, and working with school districts to provide a very quick screening of the different buildings in the district, again, with an eye toward highlighting those buildings that, you know, they're great. Two thumbs up. We don't need to worry about those. What are the ones where we might want to put a little more attention? If anyone's curious, copies of each of these reports are out on the table. Please don't hesitate to take one. And the last point.
That's particularly important because in tsunami areas, the evacuation centers are the schools. And so that's got to be safe.
You touch on a very key point for our coastal communities. That is true.
Thank you.
The last point that I wanted to make is I wanted to encourage, as we look toward coming out of this earthquake, what we do differently, what we retrofit, what we do, I want to encourage us to instrument some of our school buildings. In the world of 2019, this is really easy. What's on the screen is this is actually Fairbanks. This is the seismic monitoring system in Fairbanks in the response to a fairly modest earthquake this past summer. What I would point out is those recordings scattered about town, several of those are in elementary schools. And these do double duty. A, they're important information for us that help us in our larger state mission, but they also provide specific data about that particular school that helps us foretell potentially where we might have a school or a neighborhood that is particularly susceptible for reasons we may not be aware of to a shaking before something big comes. It can help explain why certain buildings failed or didn't in a legal sense. If you ever end up in a courtroom around a building issue, that becomes very important data. And again, this is something that's really easy in 2019. It's not very expensive. And we've got lots of precedent for doing it around the school. Out on the table, there's a policy recommendation from a few years ago from the Alaska Seismic Hazards Safety Commission that specifically calls this out as a recommendation for us as a state. And with that, I'll wrap up. And I don't know how you'd like to proceed from here, move on with talks or questions. It's chair's call.
Thank you very much. Dr. West, any questions? We've already asked our questions. Yeah. Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments and appreciate the efforts you are making, and glad to hear that that you work for us. Good to know. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was an outstanding presentation.
Thank you. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Take a brief at ease. Tello, we were in another meeting. Glad to have them here. And next, we'll go on to Tim Edwards, Chief Risk Officer, University of Alaska, and Tim Lampkin.
For the record, Tim Lampkin, Staff to Senator Stevens. For the committee's information, Mr. Edwards is online, and the university submitted a video here, a two-minute video for your to view. I don't believe we have audio at this time, but I'm going to hit play to see some footage from the UAA campus of the event.
Thank you, Tim, for running that. I would guess a lot of lessons learned from those videos. Mr. Edwards, are you with us? Tim Edwards, Chief Risk Officer, University of Alaska.
Yes, this is Tim. Can you hear me?
Yes, Tim. Hear you loud and clear. Thanks so much, and thanks for that video. That's really an eye-opener that folks knew to get undercover and all the damage that occurred. So pleased to have you with us, Mr. Edwards. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Absolutely. That was a good response by our folks there, and students, staff, and everybody at the university. I'm going to have to call the slides out as I'm out from Philippines right now. So if we can go to the second slide, please.
Thank you, Tim. And just for the record, would you identify yourself and the position you hold?
Yes, I'm Timothy Edwards, and I am the Chief Risk Officer for Statewide University of Alaska.
Thank you, sir. Please go ahead.
Okay. The UA earthquake impact, over 60 facilities damaged at UAA and UAF, including Anchorage, Eagle River, Mat-Su, and Seward, with nearly $4 million worth of damages. UAA Anchorage campus closed as a result of this for about 5 days. We continue to do repairs and monitoring, and in a few slides I'll have a more update on that. And we're also in the middle right now of the FEMA reimbursement process, trying to get reimbursed for some of the expenditures of the $4 million or so dollars that we incurred in the damage due to the earthquake. Slide, please.
Hold on just 1 minute. I have a question from Senator Begich.
Just a very quick question, Tim. The thaw, of course, hasn't happened yet. Are you expecting to find more damage after the thaw?
Through the chairman, yes, sir. We are monitoring that, especially with downspouts where rain, rain downspouts and those sorts of things. And it's definitely number one on our agenda, and we'll be monitoring that as we come up to the thaw in April and May.
Thank you. And Senator Hughes has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards, for being here. Are you repeating assessments because of all the aftershocks? Rotating back and checking the same 60 facilities and additional facilities?
Yes, through the chairman, yes, ma'am, we are. We are continually doing that. We have several meetings with our facilities managers, people monitoring daily if we do get an aftershock and making sure that we take care of that. But it's an ongoing assessment process as we continue.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Please continue.
Are we on to the third slide now?
Yes, please go ahead, Tim.
Okay. Some of the more substantial campus damage that we did incur was the boilers offline at three of our residence halls. Those didn't stay offline too long. We were able to get them back up and running. Chugiak Eagle River campus was damaged very significantly. In the middle college was temporarily relocated. I will say that the Eagle River campus is back up and online now, and we are holding classes out there, and which is truly amazing compared to the damage that we had. Substantial damage to the administration building. That is the building that Chancellor Sandeen and her staff sits in. It completely come apart up there. But again, that is back up and running. They're back in those offices, and they were in there within a couple of weeks. Several fire suppression, plumbing, and coolant, the coolant being glycol, leaks at numerous facilities. All of those were caught fairly quickly in our rapid initial assessment and stopped through various means, and we got those back online as quick as possible. And I'll give you an example. If you could go to the next slide, please.
Senator Begich has a question.
This was the fire.
Sorry, Senator Birch.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at a picture. It looks like a restroom here, and there are some big, gnarly-looking concrete blocks tumbled around in the floor. Where did those come from?
Sometimes in some of the walls, it wasn't reinforced concrete, and that's an issue that we're looking into as we go through and do other assessments. This wasn't at one of our facilities. we leased the Chugiak facility. And that's since been corrected out there. But when they're not reinforced with rebar, these things can come loose and cause problems very quickly. You're correct.
Clearly. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Birch. Please go ahead, Mr. Edwards.
Okay. Should be a picture there of the flooding at the Alaska Airlines Center at the basketball court. If you can see just left of the scoreboard there, there's a substantial amount of water coming down from the fire suppression system. And initially, we really watched this close because we was afraid it was going to warp the boards there on the floor. But we got it cleaned up. The response was amazing. We got everything shut off, and it didn't cause any damage. Still monitoring to make sure, you know, in the future. But right now, that's all still going good, and that's a great example of what can happen. Next slide, please.
Yes, we're on the student union.
This is the student union. And go ahead.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay, this is a student union, and a good example of kind of what happened in a lot of the areas was a lot of the ceiling tiles, the lights, those sorts of things came down very rapidly. You've probably seen that in the video. And so the student union was substantially damaged due to this. Within just 7 or 8 days, we had all this put back together with our response teams and got it back up and running. Slide, please. One thing that kind of caused us a little headache was this water main break at the engineering and computation building. Our response team got this under control very quickly. We put number one priority on this with the team there, the incident management team at UAA. This could have got out of control and caused a lot of major damage. It was the flooding was getting close to a lot of electrical systems and those sorts of things. But we were able to work with the municipality and our team internally and get this taken care of very quickly. But this was the one major water main break we had, which was remarkable. We didn't have more, but this one was taken care of very quickly. Slide, please. And you can see the pictures here. It's pretty typical in most offices. Structurally, our buildings did really well. But internally, it was kind of like a snow globe. If you shook it, everything kind of came apart and came off the shelves and tipped over. ConocoPhillips, ANSEP, Health Sciences Building, Wells Fargo, Rasmussen Hall, Admin Humanities Building, Wendy Williamson, and the Consortium Library were the main short list of UAA facilities that were damaged the most significant. Slide, please. At the library, over 100,000 books were knocked off the shelves. We got these all picked up and put back together. There were a few books of significance that the binders were damaged, but we internally had the capability to fix those. And the dean of the library spoke with him shortly a couple days ago, and everything's back and up running at the library, which is a very significant thing for our students to be able to do their research and work there. Slide, please. With our response and repairs, again, luckily, we stay on top of this. Earthquake drill last summer is a strong culture of emergency planning. President Johnson, all the way down to our campuses, we have three emergency managers, one at each campus, and a statewide emergency manager, and over 100 people involved in that, which really prepared us even more for the earthquake in November. We were able to execute what we planned for and exercised. A big thing that happened was, or didn't happen, I should say, is no student, faculty, or staff injuries whatsoever, which was remarkable with the amount of shaking which you've seen in the video. Just like the briefer before there, there's been years of working with the schools and teaching people what to do, and they did it immediately. So we really appreciate that. Initial assessments in all buildings were complete within 36 hours, a huge team. This did occur on a Friday, so we worked through the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Even my staff went over to UAA, and we chipped in, and we did all we could to make sure we got these assessments done and get the priority straight to get the campuses back up and running. The facilities maintenance staff can't say enough for what they did. The earthquake on Friday, campus actually reopened on Tuesday. And that's just remarkable. Chancellor Sandeen put a video out, I think you can see on the inset there, and kept the communications open, everybody updated. And then as a result, the campus opened in time for finals, and we did do a commencement. So great job by everybody there. Slide, please. Through this all, I think the mantra at UAA now has become together we are unstoppable, and I won't read all that, but basically it outlines what I spoke about in this briefing. Big earthquake, a lot of people affected, but we had a response team that was just totally awesome, come together and did what we said we would do and put things back together and got our campus up and running, and it's going great now. Slide, please. Currently, earthquake repairs are 90% complete. We have a few things left that we're working on to get done, and other than that, we should be back to 100% here shortly. Next slide. And really, that's a very short brief. It kind of outlines what happened and where we're at. We don't have any significant issues at this time. We're working through it all with our claims division and working with FEMA. And without any, unless there's any other questions, that concludes my brief.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Edwards. Any questions? I certainly appreciate your being with us, and thank you for your presentation.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
On to Tim Merrick. Is Tim Merrick here? Yes, sir. Please come on forward. Mr. Merrick is a Facilities Management Department of Education Early Development. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I only have brief comments.
And just for the record, your
name. Yes. This is Tim Merrick, Facilities Manager at the Department of Education. And the brief comments I just want to make for the committee this morning are to let you know that the department has a role of obviously being interested and committed to the education of every student every day in Alaska. And when we have these kind of major events come about, often it's interesting because the department doesn't have a direct role in schools at the LEA level. With the exception that we do still have ownership of a few schools in REAAs, but increasingly we're having those titled to the school districts in those areas. They have a much better opportunity to manage those facilities as the building owners. So the department had one of their facilities staff on an airplane on Saturday morning. We spent the weekend in Matsu and Anchorage with those districts, just being a partner with them. In addition, we had staff from our school safety and branch. They're actually in Anchorage at a conference, and that unit of the department also provides a lot of trauma-centered education and training for teachers and that sort of thing, and they stepped up as well and provided department interface with school districts, counselors, and information that they could have available to deal with the situation with their students, primarily to teachers. So the department basically handles emergencies like this through the requirement of each district must insure their buildings. And the department isn't funded with an emergency fund. The statute, which provides state aid for school capital, AS 1411, provides for grant and debt reimbursement funding as provided through the legislature. Those funds are program funds that are meant for long-term investment in Alaska schools. Obviously, they could be used to make improvements such as we've been hearing from the Alaska Seismic Safety Commission, and recommendations there and those sorts of things could come as projects to the department for possible funding and put on lists of prioritized funding. So, and we do see those. But there are strong requirements for every district to insure their buildings, and generally speaking, that's what happens in the immediate response. And I don't need to say a lot more about that. I think you have testimony from school districts coming up to kind of express exactly how they went about responding to the incident that they had. So I just want to also point out that in January of 2016, when there was the earthquake in Anchorage and damaged buildings in Kenai and Anchorage, and we, following that, actually have participated with state aid in a project in Anchorage at the Romig Middle School West High to fund repairs that were initially covered by emergency funds and from the district, but that then were then submitted to the state for state aid on a prioritized basis. That project rose to a high level on the priority list and received state aid for earthquake damage repair to that school. And that could happen subsequent to the damage that you'll hear about from the districts in the schools that from the November quake as well. Some of those might, if there are costs beyond that, which is provided by FEMA, insurance, et cetera, some of those might make their way in an application to the state for funding, and we would review those, and there could be a possible, you know, funding opportunity down the road for repairing those facilities. And I'm happy to answer any questions about the department's role and how we respond in these
situations. Thank you, Mr. Merrig. Certainly, our attention, all of our attention is on the November earthquake and the damage and preparedness and where we go from there. But looking at the bigger picture, we never know. We've heard where these earthquakes and tsunamis may occur. I'm concerned that all of our coastal communities that are particularly in an area where there could be a tsunami, the schools are the evacuation center. Do you have any role in that? I know that you don't own those buildings. They're a part of a school district. But what is your role in making sure that those, particularly those evacuation centers, are stable?
So, yes, Mr. Chair, we at the department don't have a specific standard that a school must be or must not be, an emergency shelter. That's a municipal or city community decision that can be made. And as far as whether or not the funds through AS-1411, should fund a school functioning in that role or not, there has been some, question in the past about how that works out, whose responsibility is, say, for instance, to put in increased backup capacity and generation and fuel and food storage or whatever. For that, so there are some open questions regarding how those dovetail together with the actual K-12 education mission.
Thank you, Mr. Merrig.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a follow-up, though, you do, for any grants you give for school construction, you require those schools to meet the highest possible standards, hardy walls, things like that, that are designed to anticipate seismic shock. Is that correct?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Begich, we adopt the appropriate codes that are put in place by code enforcement officials, the Department of Public Safety, Department of Labor, et cetera. All are basically the state's code bodies that review national codes and decide for Alaska which are appropriate. And so those are the codes we list when we have school projects that are required to be followed. They obviously are, those buildings are superior quality buildings. But as a for instance, there is a seismic importance factor that is used in the code that is based on building type. So if it's not a building like a hospital that's intended to be fully functioning, as immediately after any major event, then a different factor is applied for those buildings and may be applied for a school within the code.
Thank you. Senator Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the department has any involvement with this or this is districts or no one is doing it, but in addition to ensuring proper codes are followed, is there any consideration of the location of the schools, not only just historic seismic activity, but also location of fault lines where it might be not approved to build a school in a certain spot, and this, that it, it's recommended not be, so that districts or the state aren't liable if something were to occur. Is there any consideration as far as the location and fault lines?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Hughes, the mostly local zoning provisions take those into account. The department has published a school site selection criteria handbook that includes some criteria related to siting in safe areas, whether it's floodplain, flood prone, slide, et cetera. But we do primarily rely on the local jurisdictions because even a community, say for instance, like the city of Bethel, which doesn't review school projects for code compliance, under the International Building Code, those go to the state fire marshal because they don't have designated jurisdiction in that community. That community still might have site review and zoning review for actual location of a building within the community. That would come under a different subset of standards. So, in a direct answer to your question, the department is not actively managing that, with the exception that we have standards whereby it's required to look at those situations and, as you're selecting a school site, be aware of what those might be, hazards might be in that location.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Any further questions? Thank you very much. I appreciate you being with us. We'll take a brief at ease to set up for the next presentation. He's online with us, and we're all set. Mr. Brown, can you hear me?
Yes, Senator Stevens, I can hear you. This is Mike Brown.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate your being here with us from the Massachusetts School District. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Great. Well, good morning, and thank you, Senators, and those participating in the testimony this morning. I'm Mike Brown. I serve as the Executive Director of Operations for the Mat-Su Borough School District. Today I'm representing our superintendent, Dr. Monica Goyette. Dr. Goyette is actually en route to Juneau this morning, so she's unavailable to present today. So quickly, we provided a two-page handout to you all to keep it fairly brief. The front of that includes a narrative of some of the schools that I'll highlight in the presentation this morning, along with some pictures of four schools on the backside of that handout that received significant earthquake damage. So to kind of give you the bottom line up front, overall status as of today. So as of December 18th, all of our schools were back in session with only one facility, Houston Middle School, deemed as not safe to occupy. And I'll talk about that in more detail here in just a minute. As far as cost to date, the district has expended approximately $1 million for earthquake repairs and response. The Mat-Su Borough has also expended approximately $800,000 for school repairs and response. So collectively, roughly $2 million to date that have been expended to address issues that we have. The Mat-Su Borough Assembly did a remarkable job in appropriating emergency funding to help us to address immediate needs, and we've gotten a great deal of support from the borough in getting schools back in up and running and in session again. So immediate response, immediately following the earthquake, our initial response efforts for facilities included structural assessments as well as various inspections of life and safety systems such as water, fire protection, and whatnot. As you've heard in earlier testimony today, a lot of emphasis on preventing further damage due to water leaks, gas leaks, things of that nature. So put a lot of emphasis on a very quick response to avoid secondary damage as a product of the earthquake. As far as repairs go, the majority of significant repairs outside of damage to the four schools listed in the narrative. So in the narrative in front of you, you have Houston Middle School, Colony High School, Wasilla Middle School, and Kinnick Elementary Schools. The majority of the damage outside of those four was really to ceiling, grid, and tile, such as damage depicted in the pictures of Colony Middle, Finger Lake Elementary, and Houston Middle Schools that are included on the back side of that handout that we provided to you this morning. As far as unsafe to occupy, our most significantly damaged school was Houston Middle School. Houston Middle suffered significant structural damage, especially in the second-story classroom wing, as well as the gymnasium. the Mat-Su Borough has already engaged with architects and engineers to assess the facility. So we're doing that detailed inspection beyond the original rapid screening that we've already gone through. We expect a report over the next month, as well as the report from our insurance adjusters. At that time, we can begin to establish the cost estimates for repair or replacement. At this point, we do know that Houston Middle damage is in the millions of dollars, with complete replacement as a possibility. To adjust for Houston Middle School being unavailable, the borough and district worked closely to place 13 portables at Houston High School. The two schools were consolidated into what is known now as Houston Junior Senior High School over winter break this past December. In just over 1 month from the 7.0 earthquake, we had reorganized and implemented a plan to keep our Houston students together while providing them a safe and healthy environment for the next year or so, as we understand this will be an extended stay. As far as the two other schools, we had some gym damage at Colony High School. That gym's been unable to be occupied since the earthquake. We expect that to open up actually this coming Monday, February 11th, for students to begin using that again, with substantial completion of that repair work completed by the end of this month. So we intend to have that wrapped up here over the next couple of weeks. As far as Kinnick Elementary School gym, that gym experienced significant ceiling grid and tile failure. So we demoed that over winter break, and those gym repairs will be completed over spring break in mid-March. So overall, I would say we are extremely fortunate that we did not have any significant injuries to students or staff that day. We learned a great deal as we have since revisited our processes and procedures that should only help to improve our preparedness moving forward. I will say staff and student actions during and immediately after the earthquake won the day. And as you've previously heard, I think Dr. West mentioned the rapid visual screening. We continue in that process, I guess kind of ironically. We had a contract with an engineering firm to conduct rapid visual screenings of all facilities in the district. We have done screenings and studies of some schools in the past. We wanted to expand that and ensure that we had that done for all schools, which, as Dr. West testified, would be able to allow us to figure out where we would want to do a further investigation or future capital improvements to make improvements to our seismic capacity in select buildings. We also have seismic upgrades. That's actually one of the projects on our six-year CIP that's on file with the Department of Education and Early Development. That's our number two priority, which includes seismic upgrades for four facilities here in the district. But all in all, I think we're very pleased with the actions by our staff and students to protect life. The way they conducted evacuations was appropriate. And then also even the follow-on with reunification and the process that we went through to ensure kids were handed back to parents and guardians correctly and safely. We had a great facilities response, as I kind of alluded to earlier, where we were able to valve off water leaks and other things that did prevent further damage from occurring in our facilities. And then we put a quick focus on getting back to normal operations, getting schools opened as quickly as possible. And I talked about the example with Houston Junior Senior High School. We are closing in on the completion of pretty significant repairs, so Colony High Gym, Kinnick Elementary Gym, those projects are going well. And then, of course, with Houston Middle School over the next month, we should be getting additional detail that would allow us to start those discussions around what those repairs or replacement might look like. And then lastly, as I mentioned with the rapid visual screening, we're already looking at moving forward, how do we make sure that we have what we need to make improvements in facilities based on what we've learned here over the past couple of months. So I appreciate your time today, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Brown, and the structural update is helpful, and you touched on the evacuation process, and sounds like we can be pretty proud of our faculty and staff. I was wondering, though, because I believe it was Palmer High, there were, and maybe this happened at other schools, where the fire alarms were going off, and so students were exiting and having to stay outside. It was quite, I don't remember the temperature, but it was pretty cold that day. And just wondering, as far as do the teachers feel like that they were adequately trained as far as evacuation and your communication systems, if sprinkler systems were triggering fire alarms, and just how, you know, considering the ceiling tiles and things all around, and this, the exiting the children, coordinating with the parents. Is there additional training needed? Were there lessons learned? Or do you think it went 100% as it should have been? I figured you probably debriefed and there may be improvements. I know that there were traffic jams as far as parents picking up students. And actually, I'm curious, too, what the process was. Did an alert go out to parents, or parents were just coming? And then, of course, you had some parents stuck in Anchorage. How did you handle those children that didn't have parents pick them up? So pretty broad question there. I just want to understand better about that. And then following that, the next week, as kids were back in school, what kind of things were teachers dealing with as far as fear level that children had, and what kind of resources were provided to help with that?
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Mr. Brown.
Right, through the chair, Senator Hughes. That's a great question. So I'll start with the communications piece. Obviously, you alluded to fire alarms going off and whatnot. One of the lessons learned, we've since had a debrief with our principals, brought all of them in and went through a pretty extensive debrief around lessons learned with the earthquake. Communications was one of the primary things that came up. One of the things we've already moved to do is to procure additional radios. So as you mentioned, where you would have chaos because a fire alarm may be going off, which would cause you to evacuate a building, one of the things we want to do is make sure we have better radio communication so the administrators in schools can communicate with more staff. So we've changed that metric for how we deploy those radios in schools across the district, and actually have ordered additional radios to essentially double up our capacity in those facilities to improve communications. So where you have that chaos and confusion, we do have devices that allow staff to communicate within the building that's not necessarily relying on building infrastructure. So having those push-to-talk or line-of-sight radios to improve communications among staff so that they can properly give direction and guidance as to what students should do, whether they should be in a stay put or whether they should actually evacuate a facility. So that's one of the things. We also leveraged, we used Blackboard mass communication or mass notification. So that was very effective in getting the word out quickly to parents. That's one of the things we quickly realized is we're going to have a lot of parents just flooding schools literally to pick up kids. So the reunification process and criteria for releasing students was very important. So the superintendent made some decisions about what that process would look like for children, wanting to ensure, like you mentioned, that there were parents that were stuck in Anchorage. So we wanted to make sure that a kid would not, even if it was a secondary school or a high school kid, that they would not necessarily or possibly be going back to a home that might have a gas leak or something because there wasn't an adult there to have checked that. So very explicit guidance was given to schools regarding the reunification process and criteria for releasing kids back to parents and guardians instead of just letting them depart on their own or leave with a friend or something along those lines. So just keeping student safety in mind. And the mass notification piece and our ability to communicate out quickly to parents is critical. Traffic was an issue and a concern for us. We would expect that with a major incident, really at any school. So we've had a lot of discussions lately, not just with amongst ourselves, but also with the Mat-Su Borough about, you know, traffic control, what that could look like, how we orchestrate a reunification site if we have to go to a secondary location. And as far as return to school, one of the things Dr. Goyette was also clear about was when we went back to schools, our facilities crews went through, our custodians cleaned up the buildings, got everything back up and to order, and I think our staff were pretty pleased when they went back into schools with how, I guess, normal or clean it was. I think they expected more damage. Our staff did a remarkable job in going through the schools and cleaning things up and making sure that it looked much different than when they left the school following the earthquake. So that was very helpful. Dr. Goyette also made sure that we had teachers had a day in classrooms before students returned. So, for for every school that reopened, they had a day where the staff were able to get into schools, kind of get into their classrooms, get that sense of normalcy, clean up what they needed to clean up, replace what they needed to place, so that when they received students the following day, they were prepared for that, and it wasn't staff and students arriving in schools at the same time. I think that was a great decision, and really helped kind of ease folks back into a normal school environment and allowed the staff to deal with their anxieties and concerns so that they could address student needs when they showed up the following day. Does that answer your question, or is there some additional information that you would like?
I'll have to say thank you. I'll have to say I'm pretty impressed because I went all over the map and you hit all the areas. I am curious as far as we were having aftershocks, and I know I personally slept in my clothes for the first few nights, and every time there was an aftershock, I mean, it did, you know, the heart would start beating, and I was just wondering, as those aftershocks were occurring, the teachers feel like they had adequate support and that the kids were doing okay. Did you have to deploy additional counseling resources? Just wondering about that.
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Hughes. I'm not aware of any specific needs that were asked for, but I do know our Office of Instruction made counselors and psychologists available to schools so that they, if they had some specific issues of trauma that needed to be addressed, that they had access to the resources that they needed.
Thank you.
Senator Begich?
Just a brief question. I'll ask it. I hopefully Dr. Bishop will also address it in her presentation. Just, are you expecting to find more damage after the thaw?
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Begich, we are expecting that may occur. We did engage with a civil engineer as well to assist in grounds inspections. So we did do what we could based on snow cover and whatnot at the time. But as we went through that process to assess facilities, we're also looking at, and we're out here in a more rural community, so we had to look at wells to make sure we didn't have any cracks in casings and issues that might lead to a contamination there. So we also conducted some grounds assessment, if you will, the best we could at the time. Obviously, as snow melts and ice peels away, we're going to have to get back out there and take a look at that again. So as was previously mentioned, I think, from UA, is that's going to be an ongoing or continuous assessment process.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
This is a very quick one. Just wondering, does the district require schools to do regular earthquake drills? And I'm sure that's going to continue, but has that been something that the school district requires on a regular basis in all the schools?
Absolutely. Through the chair to Senator Hughes, we have drill procedures that are pretty regimented. It's funny, I was actually at Anchorage School District the other day and talking to their safety folks, so and kind of seeing what they're doing as well. But we absolutely do require those. We do ALICE drills, earthquake, fire. So those things are all done on a regular basis, and schools are required to report that in, that they've completed those drills.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Brown. Really appreciate your spending time with us and giving us an update on what you're doing in MATSU. We'll move on now to Dr. Deanna Bishop. Dr. Bishop is, of course, the superintendent of the Anchorage School District. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, please.
My name is Deanna Bishop. I'm the superintendent of the Anchorage School District, and thank you for the invite to this testimony. And I will go quite rapidly because I know that your schedule also is 10:30.
Actually, we're fine. I don't want to shortchange you on time, so just take all the time you need, and those of us who are free will continue to stay.
Okay, well, thank you. I'm going to first share that we've communicated with video, and in the YouTube age, a lot of I included a couple of videos in here. We don't have sound, but I'll speak right through them. But everything I'm going to show you is right from our website, that we've archived this through the process from the beginning. And I'm going to start with October 19th at 10:19 in the morning. Every school in Anchorage School District, every child, every adult in any office building did the Great Alaska Shakeout. And so nearly a month prior, a little over a month prior to the earthquake, everyone, 6,000 employees and 48,000 students participated in an earthquake drill. So that's a good thing to have in the state of Alaska. On our website, I'm going to just walk you through this. If you look at the Anchor School District website, everything I'm going to show you is there, ready to be absorbed if you have any further questions. Under a Hot Topics page, we have wanted to have accessibility and communication for all of our community. This, again, if you consider the population of Anchorage, about one-sixth of the entire population of Anchorage walks through an ASD school or works in an ASD school daily. So we're a very significant part of our community and wanted to reach out to our community and be sure to be accessible. On the updates, you'll find video as well as written media that will update and share information about the quake. This is just a picture of a video that I'll share at the end, which was a welcome back video. So we wanted everyone to be sure to know what was done. And the biggest question, are our kids safe? Are they safe when they come back to you? And we wanted to share with our community that, yes, we're confident they're safe. The updates were located in one place, and as you can see, November 30th, a lot of the questions coming was about communication and how did we know, how did we communicate with parents, starting from the letter to ASD staff and families the day of the earthquake that spelled out how communication would be given, what would be doing, and how they could access the most up-to-date information. The last letter was January 22nd. And that was most recently with the Eagle River Elementary and Greening Middle School, which are two middle schools taking offline for next year as well. We've had the final assessment most recently by the structural engineers, and we are now working with the entire community to really work for the best situation of kids. It may not be what it looks like immediately after the earthquake. Our primary goal immediately after the earthquake was to keep students with their teachers that they had so that, you know, that social-emotional part of that tragedy and that emergency, that our teachers are the best people to work with that and the students and their families. But now that we have a natural break coming up in the summer, we wanted to go back to the community to talk about would you like to, you know, would rezoning be better than splitting up grade levels and things like that. So we're very transparent with the process. Lots of emotion involved in the process, so it's going to take some time, but we're happy to do the work. The ASD Road to Recovery, this is an update of all of our information regarding what happened from the very first rapid assessment that took place the day of the earthquake, as well as to the next steps for which we did participate. In the Ed Center, we did have an operation center, and this was on the facility side. And just to share with you, every building, all 92 facilities, plus another rented, we kept track of everything. When we talk about, and there's papers there about a yellow school or a red tag school or a green tag, those are universal demarcations for the safety. But we, in addition, had to be mission ready. So by statutory requirements, schools have a higher level of readiness than a general building. So we had to ensure then that are those fire alarms working again? Are those panic buttons working again? Has the playground equipment been assessed as well? Because when kids go back to school, they'll go back out to recess. So we had to really take a look at all different aspects of a school, students. Is the kitchen ready for lunch? So this really kept an ongoing assessment of the capital and actually school mission ready functions. And that group operated for, really it stayed in the district building for a month after the earthquake. To share with you how we communicated to our families, we did set up the spreadsheet within the first 3 days of the earthquake. Our parents wanted to know what happened to my school, what's going on with my school in my neighborhood. And we moved schools that were assessed from red, yellow, green, and then, of course, we created our own mission ready. This resides right on our website. At any one time during the earthquake, there were 100 people on that looking at it. And so up-to-date information as that Operations Center, Capital Center, upgraded a school, it was immediately upgraded here so that the information was transparent, it was up to date, no secrets. If we knew it, our families knew it, and that was important to us. On the website, there's highlighted news and resources. And as mentioned previously by our seismologist, we had a student response. And this was serendipitous. We actually had a supervisor of a teacher filming, because we don't have video in our classrooms, but we had filming in this classroom because she was looking at his teaching. And so we were able to see the student's response. And this is the video, and it doesn't have any, he's teaching up at the front, sharing with the students. He did not say, hey, there's an earthquake, but the kids felt it. They were under there first. This goes on to show, you can actually hear him giving instructions. You hear the students, they're not talking right now, but as soon as it stops shaking, he says, you know, if there's any, you know, smoke in the room, or you know, there's any debris, cover your mouth with your shirt. At a time that it stops shaking, he requests, he does say, if you have a cell phone, stay under the table, but you can text your families, tell them you're okay. And the little boy in the red over there on the right, you can't really see it, he reaches above the table, his cell phone sitting right on top of the table on the right-hand side there, and you'll see him reach up. Mike out in Mat-Su mentioned Alice drills and other drills. Part of those drills is to be alert. The A in Alice is alert. And so we do teach our kids to be alert and then listen for instructions. So he says to the kids, the teacher in this video, and it's online with sound, says, okay, I'm going to get up. I'm going to look. You guys stay under. What is it that we should do? And they say, we should listen for instructions. And so they are actually repeating back to him. Interestingly enough, this video caught, and I had, you know, PBS channels for children and everyday heroes come and do some filming in Alaska. And one of the funny things that one of the reporters asked me, or the interviewer said, when you first receive the earthquake notification that you're going to have one, what did you do? And I was like, well, that doesn't really happen here. So I was glad that the seismologist shared that and gave evidence to that, because he was surprised. He's like, so those kids knew what to do? And I was like, yes, preparation matters. The training matters. The Great Alaska Shakeout matters. And like Mat-Su, our kids did well. They were not injured. They, you know, just moved right along. They took it seriously too. These are middle school kids, most of them boys. Not that there would be any problem with that, but if you've ever been in a middle school, it's just a goofy age. And they were serious at this time. They knew when it was time to work together. So with that, this was the Emergency Operations Center set up the day of the earthquake. The primary focus first was students and staff safety, and then reunification with families, and then updates were shared to refine, and that we covered all aspects of the school to ensure that all that we could do to save the facility then, once people were out and safe, that we could do that with those rapid assessments. Initially, just so everyone knows, we had about 24,000 students in buildings, and we had it happen right before elementary school started. We had 12,000 students on school buses on the roads, and the other students were walkers or didn't yet arrive. They were still home with their families. You saw many pictures on the website. There's a photo gallery of about 70 pictures, similar to other things you have seen, so I won't spend too much time there. In our damage assessment, 15 schools had the most significant damage out of our 92 facilities, over 100 different schools that we only own 92 of them, though. And seven happened to be in the Eagle River Chugach area. Greening Middle School and Eagle River Elementary School, the two top ones, are the ones taken offline for next year, and presently the students are housed in different locations. We did close school for a week, and two of those days all staff were out so that we can ensure all buildings were safe for staff to re-enter. However, after that, while students were home, everyone was reemployed, from our bus drivers to our aides to our teachers, because we used our own internal employees to move classrooms. So schools that had no damage Lots of them were just fine. The teachers were reassigned to these schools to help the teachers put things back together. And they didn't have to, but if they wanted to, it was amazing. It was a time between Thanksgiving and Christmas. When you work an hourly wage, that's a very significant hit, a week off of work. Our bus drivers were our movers. We had people, aides and other teachers, packing up teachers in one school and their classrooms to move to another. We transported that on our own school buses and unpacked it. So it was truly amazing. People were amazing to get schools up and running for all students within a week. As mentioned, FEMA's on site February 4th. There is a time clock that starts with that, 60 days to respond to FEMA with your plans. And really FEMA and the way it works is really a negotiation with FEMA, that you start negotiating the loss and the damage. And our damage thus far is that we've expended is a little over $22 million. $5 million of that we have received invoices. Many of these costs are reimbursable through insurance. There was some asks about insurance. We don't have earthquake insurance per se on the buildings, but the contents of the buildings and what occurred after the earthquake, we do. So the water damage is insurable. And our insurance adjusters were called us the day of the earthquake. When we contacted them November 30th, we already had them online and sharing information. And so a lot of our costs while we're expending it now are reimbursable once those things move through. And finally, I just want to share, we had a video that we shared with families the night before they came back to say, yes, your students are safe. There isn't sound, but I can walk you through it. Again, the YouTube age of 2 minutes or less video. We just wanted to communicate the way that our families receive it. I have no idea where I could put this up, but it's talking about there might be a lot of questions that people have. We want to let them know that, show them pictures of what truly was out there, what we encountered, but then show them that their classrooms are mission ready. Mission ready for us was that we were able to receive students.
Mr. Chairman, just a
question. Yes, Senator Begich.
Just the same question I've asked. Do you expect to find more damage after the thaw?
Absolutely, Senator, especially in parking lot damage and ground damage, because it is covered, and as well as roofing damage. And I wanted to share just a piece. We have been, you know, maybe sometimes a little criticism for the bonding or the cost of school construction. And we've replaced roofs over the last several years in our buildings. In comparison to, I worked in Matsu at one time. A lot of the schools in Matsu are new. It's a growing community. Schools in Anchorage are older and built under different code. So at the time that we replace roofs, we also upgrade them to seismic codes. And that's why, and our community is behind us now understanding how can a roof cost $2 to $3 million when in you know, in the retail world, that's not the same. Well, it is due to upgrading the seismic structure as well when we put the new roofs on. The buildings such as Diamond High, the newer areas of the school, went through the earthquake just fine. The original areas were the ones with the problems. We know that building codes work. It was demonstrated in our schools. And we are just... It's a great place to be. Alaska came together. There's a lot of work to do. It's not over. We, again, in Chugach Eagle River area, really want to resolve some of the concerns from our families there who feel a loss, a greater loss than most. But we're willing to do the work and really have school go on. It's important for our community. In regard to what we did when kids come back, it is important, just like in emergency when they have you talking through what's your age, what's your this, how they ask you questions, using the frontal part of your brain assists in basically regulating that emotional side. And so for us, it was important to get back to normalcy, not only for our adults, but for our children, to move through this emergency and this event and learn from it and be able to talk about it with their peers and, you know, continue to learn. So thank you.
Oh, yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank you and Senator Hughes, because I know earthquakes are something that's important to you, too, earthquake readiness. Dr. Bishop, I just want to thank you for preparing the students. When I was home with my 11-year-old son when the earthquake hit, and he grabbed my hand without speaking a word, and we ducked under the kitchen table. And then he said, "Mom, it's going to be okay." So I think that the training that you do is really important, and I appreciate that. I grew up in Anchorage, you know, right by West High School after the 64 quake, and anyone who went to West High knows, and we talk about the fact that, well, there used to be a whole level that is no longer there because of the 64 quake. So I appreciate that you get our kids ready. As I mentioned to you before the hearing today, I had a meeting with the Alaska Seismic Hazards Commission, and I really appreciate them being here and testifying. And one of the things that they do is they provide information on the FEMA rapid visual screening risk results, which essentially estimate the collapse probability of our schools. And as you mentioned, our schools are really important, and the number of people that we have in the Anchorage School District and families is pretty significant. And my district actually has the state's largest elementary school, Sand Lake Elementary School. When I had that meeting with them, they mentioned, and I asked, you know, why isn't the Anchorage School District, why aren't the results listed on their brochure, which is something that I have here? And they had indicated to me that the municipality does not provide that information to them. And I was just wondering if that is in case the fact, would you work with me and my office on addressing that situation? Because I think that the fact that Anchorage Public Schools are left off of this transparency and public information is something that really needs to get out to the parents of the children who are in our schools. We have so many, and I think that the parents deserve to have that information, and I want to work with you and the commission to make sure that that information is out there for parents.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Costello. Absolutely. In the question prior to this testimony, I was able to call back to our folks at the Capitol and our chief of operations, and we have not been contacted at all. So we will look into it. We have not been involved and not requested. So we work with the municipality. While we run the schools and the facilities, the municipality owns them. And so we'll circle back with them.
Yes, please, Senator Costello.
And thank you. And I wanted to share with you a personal story that one of your contractors dealing with the music department for the Anchorage School District, and the person has all the contact information for families who have kids in the music programs, reached out immediately after the quake and offered a week-long earthquake band camp, which my kids both participated in. So while we had that week off from school, we invested in music, and I just wanted to give you a shout-out for having those people, and I thought it was a wonderful opportunity to have a week of music while you were working with the schools and touring the schools. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Senator Hughes.
Thank you. Appreciate everything that you've done and the drills and the leadership you've taken in the state as far as the districts in that regard. I was wondering just how it works with the FEMA funding. Is that money that will come directly to the districts, or will that be routed through the legislative process? So that's one, FEMA money. And the second one, how is it going to work with the students have a required number of days they're supposed to attend in the year, and because school wasn't in session, are you able to kind of absorb that, or will there have to be makeup days?
Sure. That's a great question. Through Senator Stevens to Senator Hughes. I'll start with the days. Anchorage does build in additional days into our calendar to meet the minimum of 170 school days. We actually have a greater amount of school days, so we were able to use some of those. The commissioner called us, was on our site the day of and saying, "I'll work with you, let us know." So we did have 3 days off for students, and we are making those up in 2 weeks, partial of them. So we're making up 1.5 days of those, and 1.5 days were excused by the state for such a significant event. So we're doing our due diligence to get the learning in, and I believe that the participation from DEED and the support there really assisted us because for families, extending the school year is difficult. And so we're using some other days that we had planned off for in-service and the like to be able to make those up. Graduations, student travel, student work, kids going to the military, we just have so many significant concerns from our parents and our community that the state worked with us. In regard to FEMA, I don't believe that is a legislative process at this time in regard to the buildings. It's not a bonding. I believe it's directly with the entities of the city and the university and the school district, and we would work with the city in regard to identifying the needs and supplying, you know, the work, and then they would make that decision. But it is a negotiation. It isn't a given, and we have to demonstrate those needs. Of course, it is, DEED is involved in regard to FEMA working with the state, but I don't think it's not it doesn't go through like a bonding process or things like that. It's specifically an approval by the federal government of the need through a negotiation of deciding how much, up to 75%, that they will reimburse.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bishop. So obviously preparation is really important. The kids know what to do. The teachers know what to do. A lot of lessons learned, I'm sure. But it looks like we're really pretty lucky it wasn't worse. I mean, it has been in the past in Anchorage and around the state. What is the district's responsibility if it were to be worse? I mean, are you an evacuation site at all, the schools, if many people are homeless because of an earthquake?
Correct. Yes, Senator Stevens, we are. Many of our schools are evacuation sites, and we do have, through our emergency response, food, water, blankets, enough for 3 days to house the number of children and families in different areas. We've worked with the municipality on that. And primarily, even structurally, a lot of our schools weren't damaged. What happened was the older HVAC systems, buildings are heated with water. So if you think about water damage, in your home, you're usually thinking, oh, the kitchen or the bathroom. And in a school, because of sprinkler systems, it's in every classroom. And so the damage that we had was extensive water damage. But structurally, once we could, you know, shut that water off, the building was fine. You could fix those and have that site. So really primarily anything structural would be of concern. And again, the different ages of the building, the time of the actually, we've kind of narrowed down. It's interesting. We're taking a look at the time that the buildings were built really did have something to do with, and the different iterations of upgrades did have something to do with whether they were standing or not. But that is concerning to us. And honestly, starting on November 30th, the city wanted to identify, because it did not know, the municipality, how extensive the damage was. And they knew that they would have to have evacuation sites as well for families. And so some of our schools were green-lined for them right away to get people in if needed. And it really just worked. Practice does help us prepare.
Thank you, Dr. Bishop. Further questions? Well, thank you very much for being available, for being in front of us. Appreciate your time. Appreciate the testimony of all of the presenters. It was excellent material for us to learn and receive. Nothing further to come before us. We are adjourned at